From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Czech emigre Arnošt Lustig, one of that country's most prominent writers. His new novel, Lovely Green Eyes, is the story of a 15-year-old girl at Auschwitz and the compromise she makes to stay alive. Lustig himself is a survivor of three Nazi death camps. Most of his career has been devoted to writing about the war and the Holocaust. Also, celebrity chef Mario Batali, host of cooking shows and co-owner of four Manhattan restaurants. He collects some of his best contemporary Italian recipes in the Babbo Cookbook. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews On Being Ill, an essay first published in 1925 by Virginia Woolf, now reprinted in book form. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Emergency workers and survivors are cleaning up after a series of weekend storms ripped through a half dozen states. Tornadoes spawned by the storms left at least 35 people dead and more than 200 injured. The American Red Cross provided hot meals to storm victims in Alabama, where at least 10 people were killed. Butler Kane reports from Alabama Public Radio.
Alabama Red Cross volunteers provided breakfast and lunch to the victims of Sunday night's severe weather. Field services manager Anna Trefethen says many residents are trying to recover some of their belongings, so the Red Cross is bringing the meals to them.
We have feeding out in the community. Most of the population is out assessing their own homes. So we have what we call emergency response vehicles out in the field.
Volunteers are delivering supplies and determining which families need vouchers to buy clothes, food, and other necessities. The Red Cross also is helping local and state emergency workers assess storm damage. For NPR News, I'm Butler Kane in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Democrats will remain in charge of the Senate, at least for the beginning of the lame duck session. That's because Minnesota's Dean Barkley says he'll remain independent after he's sworn in tomorrow to fill out the remainder of the late Senator Paul Wellstone's term. Since Barkley won't be caucusing with either the Democrats or the Republicans, the Democrats will retain their slim majority. Republicans will be able to take over as soon as election officials in Missouri certify the victory of Republican Jim Talent. Because Talent won in a special election, he'll have the right to be seated immediately, shifting the balance of power back to the GOP. President Bush's national security adviser says the UN resolution passed last Friday does not mean the U.S. is closer to war with Iraq. Condoleezza Rice's comments came during an interview on NPR's Tavis Smiley Show, which will air tomorrow. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
In the NPR interview, Rice said she hopes war can be avoided, that Iraq is now presented with a choice, to comply with UN demands or face consequences. Iraq is required to respond to the resolution by Friday. Rice said Saddam Hussein now needs to say what weapons he has and lead inspectors there.
You have to note that the threat of the use of force is why we are where we are today. It's the only reason that the Iraqi regime is considering cooperation, and we have to keep maximum pressure on this regime.
Rice says the nature of the Iraqi regime is such that if it sees any wavering on the part of the UN, then it will use that as an excuse to cheat. That, she says, is why the threat of force needs to be firm and real. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 178 points to close at 8,359. The Nasdaq lost 40 to close at 1,319. This is NPR News. The number of snowmobiles allowed in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks could increase by about 15% in each park under proposals being circulated by the National Park Service. Aaron Alpern reports from Wyoming Public Radio.
A National Park Service official says their preferred plan would allow 110 more snowmobiles every day into Yellowstone and 150 more every day into neighboring Grand Teton National Park. The proposal is being blasted by environmental groups. Chris Mell is a spokesman for the Wilderness Society.
I think the fact that the numbers are actually going to go up is a pretty clear indication of where they stand on compromise, and that is it's our way or no way. There doesn't seem to be any effort to work towards a cleaner and better park where people can visit and enjoy the park.
Snowmobiles were banned from Yellowstone and Grand Teton under President Clinton. The Bush administration reversed the ban, but has indicated it will place heavy restrictions on noise and air pollution. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Alpern in Laramie, Wyoming.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is meeting this week in Washington to revise its policy for disciplining sexually abusive priests. The president of the group, Bishop Wilton Gregory, said that church leaders are committed to protecting children. Victims groups complained that they were given no public role in the meeting, which was called after the Vatican rejected another disciplinary plan that the U.S. bishops approved 4 months ago. Church leaders in Rome argued that the earlier plan didn't give enough protection for the rights of accused priests. The plan that the bishops are considering now would have accused priests investigated in secret by special church tribunals. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 18 points or 2% to close at 876. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Arnosh Lustig is a Holocaust survivor and a novelist. He's not nearly as well known as Elie Wiesel or Primo Levi, but many critics believe he should be. The New York Times describes his work as wholly unsentimental and without self-pity. He's written 15 novels, including Night and Day, Darkness Casts No Shadow, and A Prayer for Katerina Horowitza, which was nominated for a National Book Award. Lustig was just 16 when he entered the Nazi concentration camps, first in Theresienstadt. Later, he was transported to Auschwitz and Buchenwald. After escaping from the camps at the end of the war, he returned to his native Prague, became a member of the communist movement, and began writing novels, short stories, and screenplays set during the war. He was an influential part of the Czech New Wave cinema. He also hosted radio programs. Lustig left Czechoslovakia shortly before the Soviet invasion in 1968 and emigrated to the U.S. He teaches literature and film now at American University. His new novel is Lovely Green Eyes, about a young Jewish girl who survives the war by passing as a Gentile and working as a prostitute in a brothel for German soldiers. We begin with a reading.
This is a story of my love. It is about love almost as much as it is about killing. About one of love's many faces, killing. It is about number 232 Ost, the army brothel that stood in the agricultural estate by the River Sun before the German army retreated farther west. About 21 days, about what a girl of 15 endured. About what it means to have the choice of going on living or being killed, between choosing to go to the gas chamber or volunteering to work in a field brothel as an Aryan girl. It is about what memory or oblivion will or will not do. I fell in love with Hanka Kaudersova's smile, with the wrinkles of a now 16 years old, with the effect her face had on me. What saves me, apart from the uncertainty of it, is time. They are fragments out of which an event is composed. There are its colors and shades, and there is horror.
Arnold Lustig, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good morning.
I was thinking that in one sense, this novel is about young people whose lives and their love, their even their erotic imagination, is twisted by war and brutality. What did you find interesting about that side of the Holocaust story?
I tell you, erotic was sometimes the last freedom of people. It was a limited freedom, but it existed. It existed and it represented beauty of life, of man. And to omit it would be a mistake. It existed. It existed when people were not completely hungry. When you are hungry, there is no erotic, there is no sex. But when you are not starving, literally, so there is, especially among young people, erotic.
I was also thinking that, Hanka, or Skinny, as this girl is known in the brothel, is thrown back on her instincts in her encounters with these German soldiers in the brothel, that it's a very elemental situation, a sexual encounter, buying sex, and she has a very elemental fear of giving herself away as a Jew. Is that part of what you struggle with in this book, what you're exploring, what people rely on when they're pressed?
I tell you, my motives was a kind of anger at the Nazis, what they did, how they twisted life of people. And what I learned is that when somebody makes you into an animal, so you adopt animal instincts. So this happened to Hanka. It's a fiction. It's a fiction based on hundreds of fragments of experience. And the deepest motive for that was what the Nazis did to innocent people. And Hanka was innocent. She was 15. She was a virgin. She had some fantasies about sex, but no idea about real sex because she had a lot of time. And suddenly she was in a situation to die or to be hired, sort of, quote unquote, into a German Brussels under the conditions that she will lie about her age, that she's not 15 but 18, and about her race, about her origins, that she's an Aryan girl. She looked Aryan, so this was a sort of advantage. But she had no idea what to expect. And it's an accusation of this Nazi system, how they despised dignity of men. It's really, it's a story about love and about dignity and about courage to exist under such circumstances, because not everybody would be able to do it.
I know that you once went to the ballet with Milos Forman. You went to see Baryshnikov.
Yeah.
And that was part of what gave you the idea to write about young girls in war.
I tell you what happened. Forman called me and said, look, here is Misha Baryshnikov from Petrograd, and come to the hotel. He's performing here and you are invited for some brandy. So I went and saw him exercising for Nutcracker for the next day. And he invited my family for Nutcracker for the opening evening. And in the second act of Nutcracker, it's a beautiful act. It's about snowflakes, 16 years old girls are dancing. It's so moving and so beautiful. And my daughter suddenly, sitting next to me, said, Father, what happened to you? And I said, I will tell you later, because I had got a horrible idea that these beautiful girls on stage are Jewish. And if they would be Jewish, they would pack them into a railroad car and kill them. And this was only an idea, but it was scary, this idea. And I decided to write for my daughter a book. So I told her a horrible thing, Barbara. I told her, look, I am going to write about a girl like you who became a prostitute but wanted to save her soul. So tell me everything about life of 16 years old girl. So she did. I wrote the book, let her read it. And she said, but Father, there are too many juices.
You mean she meant it was there was too much sex in it? Too much sex and the body?
Yeah. And so I forgot it. I put it into a drawer and really forgot it. But 5 years later, she asked me and said, Father, what happened with that book? I said, you didn't like it because there was too much of sex. But she said, but then I was 16, 17, but now I am 22. So I let her read it again, and she said, it's fine. It's not about sex. It's about morality.
I find this so poignant to think that you talk to your daughter this way. I'm also thinking that so many survivors never spoke of their past, and especially not to their children, that they wanted to shelter them, that they didn't want to rob them of innocence or impose their experience, their pain on their children's imaginations.
I didn't. You are right. I didn't speak about it to my daughter, but this evening I had to speak to her. And then I discovered that speaking or not speaking, she had nightmares anyway.
You said you asked her about what it's like to be a 16-year-old. Did you ask her about her dreams, her fantasies, her life?
Yes,
exactly. Her life?
And I told her that I'm not interested in any explicit sex, that I am interested in what it does to her. What are her feelings? That I am really not interested in any details of sex in case that she has some. And she really told me beautiful things. For instance, I used a dream where she steals a coupon for food, which means that she will be taken out from a transport because the rule was that if I survived, Barbara, like now talking to you as a survivor, someone else had to be killed. And this is this strange feeling of guilt of every survivor.
You write about a lot of women.
You know, in camps, women were treated so horribly because Nazis didn't like women. They thought that woman belongs to church, to bed, or into the kitchen, and they humiliated women. You know, I saw my mother, for instance, walking naked through the mud, and I saw she's walking in Auschwitz to the gas chamber. And there is so much dignity in women, and they have to endure so much more than men. So I came from camps with respect for women. And, you know, when you have this experience, you cannot get rid of it. So it's in me.
Can I ask you a real personal question now, not as if these weren't personal questions, but had you had any sexual experience before you were sent to the camps?
No, I was young. I had only fantasies, and we did what all boys are doing, you know. But I had no, I tell you, when I was 16, so my father, I was working with my father, and I was in love with my father, was the best father. He never beat me, for instance. And we were working hard on the railroad, so we were getting double portions of food. And at a certain moment, my father started to ask me if I was with a woman, and I was embarrassed because I knew everything about it, but I never was. And I said, Father, leave me alone. But then I got angry and went to a prostitute who was a horseback rider and a beautiful girl, 20 years old. Her real name was Inge, and she was known for selling herself for margarine and sugar and whatever. So I told her if she can do it with me, and she said, if I did it with someone else. I said, no, but I really know everything about it. So she said, okay, so come this day. And she said that I will be number 11 or 13. This I don't remember, but it was over 10. So I was the last one, and she was very nice to me, but I didn't like it. I said, my God, if that's all what my father wants and people dream about. But the more time passed, the more romantic it seemed, like looking back. And so I went to her again, and we became friends. And when we left for Auschwitz, so boys who knew that we are going to die said, so bring this girl, and no one will leave as a virgin. So I brought her, and really no one left as a virgin from these boys. The youngest was 14 years old, and his name was Milanek Oppenheimer, Milan Oppenheimer. And when I survived, I visited his parents. And he died a horrible death. And I'm not going to speak about it, but it was horrible.
In the camps?
In camps, mm-hmm. They amputated his legs and threw him alive to the bottom of a railroad car. And one day, when I invited his father to radio, because he liked this canteen and we had really good things, coffee and cakes, so he started crying, and I didn't know what to do with him, so I told him, Mr. Oppenheimer, I have to tell you that before Milanek went to Auschwitz, so we invited a beautiful woman, and she made love to Milanek. So he went to Auschwitz experience. And this man started smiling mildly, crying and smiling. And I knew in that moment what it meant for my father to be with a woman. You know, it's maybe for fathers, it's initiation in life, in some adult life, and fathers don't want to cheat their children. So this was my experience, Barbara.
So it was a comfort that you were able to offer this father of your friend, that, yeah, that his son did not go to his death without,
exactly.
without experience with women.
He was happy, quote unquote.
Arnos Lustig's new novel is Lovely Green Eyes. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Arnos Lustig. He is one of the leading Czech-born writers of the past century. He's a survivor of the concentration camps during World War II and the author of many books set during the war and afterwards, including his latest novel to be translated into English, Lovely Green Eyes. Arnos, you grew up in Terezin, which is before the war, a town in Czechoslovakia and the site of Terezinstadt, the Nazi ghetto and concentration camp. As a young boy, what did you know about the mounting Nazi horror? Did you see the Nazis build the camp before your eyes?
It was built by Jews, so everybody had to see it, and we all were parts of building it, because the city was originally for 5,000 people, and Nazi packed over 60,000 there. So there was building going on all the time, and I was one of those builders, quote unquote. I was working, cleaning streets and building the railroad, which at the end took us directly to Auschwitz. And Nazis wanted, they said to our leaders, and now prove to us that you are not Luftmenschen, people of the air, that you can take care of yourself and build an exemplary ghetto. It was a fake, of course. They wanted to concentrate people from the occupied Europe and to organize their transfer to the liquidation camps like Treblinka, Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, and so on and so on.
It was also a propaganda site. It was a model camp that the Nazis set up initially to fool a Swiss Red Cross inspection team into thinking that the Nazis were humane and building a new society, a fine new city. When you were there, were you then involved in these preparations to beautify the camp for the inspectors?
Everybody was. There was a coffee house and concerts and, you know, theater and operettas. They, Nazis, German Nazis, were really masters of fake. And they invited a corrupted Red Cross inspector who spent one afternoon in Theresienstadt and found everything very well because they didn't show him what was not so well.
You were sentenced to death, what, three times, I think you...
Yeah, three times, right. But I was sentenced definitely more times than three times. Many times I didn't know about it. Once I was in a quarantine in Auschwitz where we were waiting only to be gassed, because if you know, this is a funny side of fate, that when they were gassing Hungarian Jews, so it was good, quote-unquote, for Czech Jews.
When you were in quarantine and you were waiting to die, to be executed, what did you all do? You were with a lot of young teenagers.
First 3 days we were really scared to death, but then we were bored. So I remember that we were with a ragball, we were playing soccer, and I was a goalie between two posts, and the electricity wire had 10,000 volts, and I knew that I cannot lose a ball because it would be end of our play. And came an SS man, very elegant, and said, "What are you doing here?" And we told him, "So we are waiting to be gassed, and in the meantime we are playing soccer." And he couldn't believe it. And I, you know, my nature makes me remember this almost funny, bizarre episodes, because as a writing man, I'm looking for something what's not average, because, you know, as writers we know that average is our enemy, that things have to be worse than bad or better than good. This is the approach of every writer. And, you know, I don't believe that one writer can describe Holocaust. It has to be many writers together to create a picture. One writer is not enough. No one writer can make it, even if he would be Leo Tolstoy.
Novelist Arnoš Lustig. His new book is Lovely Green Eyes. We'll continue our conversation after the break. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audi, the luxury car company with quattro all-wheel drive in every model line. Details at AudiUSA.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Parachute Infantry, an American paratrooper's memoir of D-Day and the fall of the Third Reich by David Kenyon Webster, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Czech writer Arnoš Lustig. Also, we talk with chef Mario Batali, cooking show host, restaurant owner, and author of several Italian cookbooks. And Maureen Corrigan reviews On Being Ill, a reprint of a Virginia Woolf essay. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Back with Czech writer Arnoš Lustig. His many novels and short stories are set during World War II. Lustig is a Holocaust survivor. After he escaped the camps, he returned to his native city, Prague, and joined the newly formed Communist Party. He became a journalist, novelist, and screenwriter. Like his contemporaries Miloš Forman and Václav Havel, he criticized the party's policies. Lustig emigrated to the U.S. in 1968 and now teaches literature at American University. He was recently featured in the film Fighter, directed by Armir Barlev, in which he returns to Prague with his friend and fellow Czech emigre Jan Wiener and retraces the journey Wiener took in his flight from the Nazis. During the filming, the two friends argued about the separate paths their lives took after the war. Wiener was accused of being a British spy by the Czech government and imprisoned in a communist labor camp. In this clip from Fighter, Lustig explains his own choices to his friend.
I tell you, it's not a joke that billion people voted communist. It must mean that the illusion was horribly strong.
No, it meant
for some
that the government was extremely powerful and that these people thought it was for keeps and that it would be a good thing to join the winners. And that's why they stayed in the party, to have an easier life.
This is one way. This is your way. I don't agree with you completely,
Hansa. And to pursue their own ambitions.
I would ask as a question. Everybody should ask him a question. How many people did you denounce? How many people did you harm? How many people did you beat? How many people did you kill? I didn't denounce, didn't harm, didn't beat, didn't kill. I feel clean.
I have absolutely no doubt about that.
I know, absolutely, but I was communist, so I was a stupido. So you can give me, for politics, a terrible grade.
I give you, for politics, a 3-.
You know this.
You're close to many Czech intellectuals, émigrés, to Václav Havel, Josef Sereky, Miloš Forman, and I imagine you've had the same kinds of conversations and arguments even with them that you had with Jan Wiener, looking back over your experience in Prague after the war and your belief, your support of communism.
You know, support of communism, it was an experiment. It was a beautiful experiment which completely failed. And at 18, you are not as clever as at 76. Clever, quote unquote, you know. So, and we had, you know, the party was weak, really, from 58 till 68. The party was very liberal. And we could make films and write books as we wished. They only told us, you can do whatever you like, only don't attack two things, socialism and the Soviet Union. And I was writing about Jews, and Forman was making movies about the bizarre side of life, and so on and so on. We really had beautiful 10 years. Then it ended.
When did you begin to lose faith? And when did you become aware of surveillance, of betrayals, of...
When I found out that in my country they are concentration camps for so-called enemy of people, this was too much for me. Because I thought that communism means more tolerance, more democracy. It was an ideal which failed. And I felt sick. I really felt sick. And I criticized the party, you know. I had 5... serious warning to be expelled from the party. But because I had so-called clean hands, I didn't collaborate with the Nazis. I came from the camp. So I was a clean-hand man in the party. So they never expelled me, only later when I was already in the United States. But, you know, it's very complicated. When there is a totalitarian regime, there is only one party. And if you want to exist, you have to be part of this party. But there were so many elements. They were Democrats, fascists, religious people, because there was no other party. So this party was a conglomerate of many elements.
Are you involved in the politics of the Czech Republic now?
No, I am not involved because nature of writing is different than nature of politics. You know, in politics, quoting Khrushchev, the duty of a politician is to convince people in a village where there is no river to build a bridge. And literature has different nature. Literature is looking for the most profound truth, not tainted by any lie or mistake or whatever. So being a politician is not for me.
How much time do you spend in the Czech Republic? How often do you go, and who do you hang out with when you're there?
Barbara, I spend as much time as possible because I feel like a sardine in the sea. It's my home, you know. I am at home there. But at the same time, I am very happy that I can go back to America. And in America, I am looking forward to go to Prague. I cannot work in Prague, to tell you the truth, because there is too much excitement for me. And America is an ideal place for me to write, because nobody bothers me. I teach, I go home, and I write. And, you know, America is a better place to work for me, to concentrate.
So in Prague, you're too busy talking to old friends?
Yeah, it's so exciting. I get up at 5 in the morning because I'm so excited what it expects me to do during the day, but it's very bad for work. But at least then I'm longing to work.
Amidst all the research and your books and the film, there was also a whole bunch of information about your passion for soccer and pages and pages from a website devoted just to your passion for soccer. And I'm remembering that you said that soccer had a place in your past when you played in the camps. Is there a lifelong connection there?
I tell you, so everybody has some hobbies and inclinations. So I love soccer. It's one of the most elegant games invented. So I played soccer in camp where the German officers were betting on their own teams. And if somebody didn't perform well, they sent him to the East. But in the meantime, it was a lot of fun to play. And with my students, not now, unfortunately, you know, age makes me slower and slower, but in my mind, I am still playing with my students soccer, and it's a good game.
So the memory has been transformed over the years.
Yeah, so now I play in my memory. So don't believe to those website stories.
Arnoš Lustig's new novel is Lovely Green Eyes. He's featured in the documentary film Fighter, which is available on video. Coming up, Chef Mario Batali. This is Fresh Air. Warm lamb's tongue in a black truffle vinaigrette with pecorino and a 3-minute egg. Fennel-dusted sweetbreads and sweet pea flan. These are just some of the dishes on the menu at Mario Batali's popular upscale Manhattan restaurant, Babbo. But alongside the esoterica are also such simple offerings as spaghetti with 100 tomatoes. That mix sums up Batali's deeply researched approach to Italian cooking, which Italian food fans can enjoy at the 3 other restaurants he co-owns in the city, or can learn to reproduce at home from watching him on his cooking shows on the Food Network. Although Batali is from an Italian-American family, he didn't specialize in the cuisine until he apprenticed at a little mountainside family-run trattoria near Bologna called La Volta. When he arrived at La Volta, the chef and owner Beta asked him what kinds of pasta he knew how to make.
spaghetti with lobster and green Thai curry and, you know, this and that. And she looks at me like I'm from another planet. And she says, well, this is how we make our pasta. Do you want to learn? I'm like, well, that's exactly why I'm here. So we started by making what we called 24 eggs worth of pasta, which is an egg per 100 grams of flour, this double zero flour. And we mix it up in the giant well method, and then we knead it by hand. And then instead of running it through a pasta machine, she starts rolling it out with this giant wooden dowel. Well, it turns out that in Emilia-Romagna, there's this beautiful culture of making handmade pasta between a wooden dowel and a wooden board. And in their opinion, the texture that you get from these two more rougher textures is something that allows the pasta to hold the condiment or the sauce a little bit better. And it has a certain mouthfeel to it, which is very important to the Emilia-Romagna culture, the way things actually are perceived on your tongue and in your mouth as you chew them. As opposed to the way that traditionally pasta is made, which is rolled through two metal smooth dowels, which in turn is still a very good thing, but it's a little different, and they roll it, and it becomes a little bit what they call liscio, or more smooth. So we learned how to make this, and I just thought, oh, geez, this is the bomb. I thought it was the coolest thing, and it was something that, you know, I couldn't master in a week. It took me literally 4 or 5 weeks to get it down where I could be trusted to roll out the dough between the rolling pin and the dowel.
Is this how you still make pasta?
At this point, no. Now we make it with an electric machine that has wooden dowels or metal dowels because it just takes so much longer. And right now I have at Baba, we have two guys who work 50 hours a week each. So that's 100 man or people hours a week just making the noodles for our restaurant that only serves dinner.
So give us an example of a recipe or a dish or an inspiration that you brought back with you from La Volta that you use in your restaurants.
Well, something as simple as what is seemingly as simple as a ragu bolognese, the classic meat sauce, is something I learned there that is easier than pie and yet all based on how you do it. And you take equal portion, equal percentage, equal weight of ground veal, ground beef, and ground pork, relatively fatty, maybe shoulder pieces, not necessarily loins. And you cook a third of that volume in celery, onions, and carrots, chopped very, very fine in a combination of butter and olive oil until it's very, very soft. Then you add that meat and you cook it until it starts to brown, which seems like a very quick step, but it takes literally an hour to an hour and 20 minutes before it really starts to brown, because what it has to do is exude most of its own fat and then start cooking in that very fat itself. So then you leave the fat in there, then you add first, tomato conserva, which is like our double tomato paste. No canned tomatoes or anything, just the tomato paste. Cook that until it basically dries away. Then you add milk and cook that until it dries away. Then you add white wine, and cook that until it dries away. Then you add a little bit of their brodo, the brodo, which was not necessarily like our chicken stock. It would have like one beef bone, one chicken, one onion, one carrot, and two peppercorns. And they would make a broth out of that, which is there for their tortellini eventually. But they would use that to cook. And then you'd allow it to just simmer on just the pilot light itself for 2.5 to 3 hours. And then that's where you got ragu bolognese. And to this day, we make it just like that at all the restaurants.
There's another popular dish at Babbo, beef cheeks. And I've noticed now in New York that you can hardly swing a dead cat without hitting a restaurant that serves beef cheeks.
They have taken New York by storm.
Yeah, what's the allure? Why do I want to eat beef cheeks?
Well, beef cheeks are very succulent. A lot of Americans' misconception with what makes things taste like big or with huge flavor is that the most tender is often enough, probably the least flavorful. In my opinion, the filet mignon or the tenderloin of beef has very little flavor, but is interesting for many because it's so tender like butter. But the cuts that actually work harder, for example, the shoulder blade or the cheek of the animal, for that much, who's chewing constantly while he's awake, it has develops sinew. And in my opinion, one of the reasons why it tastes so much better or has so much depth of flavor is because so much blood goes to these muscles and it's bringing whatever the animal's eating closer to it. So you get more sense of whatever the animal's food system was. So you get a deeper, more complex flavor with something that's got a lot of muscle and sinew in it. The only trick with that is that cooking something with muscle and sinew is not something you can just throw on the grill. You have to either braise it or slowly cook it in some other way that allows it to become more tender and a little bit more gelatinous is the word that we like to use when we're talking about something with a lot of muscle.
I know a new food that you like to offer in your restaurant is lardo. I don't know if you present it under that name, though. What is lardo?
It depends. Lardo is exactly what it sounds like, but to many people, it sounds better if I call it prosciutto bianco, which just means white prosciutto. And it's basically the fat of the neck, the back of the neck of a pig that has been salted and cured very much like a prosciutto and then hanged to allow it to age and develop flavor and mature and then sliced paper thin and either draped over warm toast or grilled bread or even just on the plate by itself and people just kind of pick it up. It's not something you'd eat a pound or two of, like a, you know, maybe salami or a lunch meat, but it's something that has a very delicate flavor, very reminiscent of some people's favorite meals, particularly in Tuscany, where they have this Lardo della Colonnata, which is aged in these marble caves up above Camaiore.
And I think you've described it as tasting. You can practically taste the last thing the pig was eating, which is not the loveliest thought. But then I understand these pigs that you raise for this eat better than I do most days. What was the last thing these pigs ate?
We have a particularly good relationship with a group called the Vermont Farmers Cooperative, who will basically do whatever we want. They want to bring us an animal that we're happy to serve. So our animals eat organic pretty much throughout their lives. And in the last 6 to 8 weeks of their lives, they eat a diet at least every day enriched with hazelnuts, walnuts, apples, and cream. And in fact, if you taste this lardo, you can not necessarily taste it like a huge flavor, but you can get the scent or the feel of the nuts and the apples without a doubt.
I'm talking with Chef Mario Batali. He is the chef and owner of the popular restaurant Babbo in Manhattan. He has a number of other restaurants in the city. He's also a cookbook author, and he's the host of a number of shows on the Food Network, including Molto Mario and a new show, Mediterranean Mario. Now, when a dish comes back to the kitchen, what do you do? And I've seen sitcoms of chefs of restaurants. I've read about this. I've heard that you all stand around and taste the dish.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we try to figure out, first of all, are we wrong? Did someone put too much salt in it? Is it radically wrong? Is it look good? Is it the probably main reason why dishes come back is either because it's undercooked or overcooked meat. So, I mean, you know, you take a look at it and you can tell in a fifth of a second, if they ordered it rare and it looks medium well, then, you know, the first thing you do is say, actually, before we even assess it, we say, what do they want? And we start making that. Then we look at the dish and try to figure out whether we're crazy or they're crazy. And, you know, often enough, it's a combination of the two. If it's a question of cooking time, though, it's obviously, you know, when you make 240 dinners a night, the grill guy might make a mistake on the temperature of the lamb rack. So basically, we try to figure out what the problem is. Then we try to convince ourselves that it wasn't our problem. And then we send another one back out.
How hard is it to get a table at one of your restaurants?
Well, the whole reservation thing, and it's quite a scam that's been cooked up by all the phone reservation people for all the restaurants in the city. There's a lot of pressure to get that 8 o'clock table on that Saturday night, and we take reservations exactly 1 month to the day in advance. As a matter of fact, today we were booking for either a Friday or a Saturday, judging from the volume of calls in December, which would be December 7th. We start taking phone calls at 10 o'clock. By 10:20, all of the main seating is filled. And the bulk of the early part of the late seating and the late part of the first seating are filled. By 10:45, there's not a table left in the restaurant, at any of my three restaurants. And that's just because New Yorkers are obsessed with eating out at Saturday night. If you walk in on any night other than Saturday night without a reservation, we have tables in each of our restaurants that are reserved, that are not reserved. They're saved for customers on a walk-in basis. So there's always a chance to get a table. One of the things that I can advise people on in terms of kind of cracking this code or this barrier, if you really want to go to a particular restaurant, try to go a little bit on the off hour. And even without a reservation, if you walk in every night, there are cancellations and no-shows at the last minute from every restaurant, from Danielle to Le Cirque down to, you know, Foutade's Parmesan Palace. And what it means is that there's a flexibility in that the restaurants we do not want people not to come in. We want them all to come in and have a good time. But there's only so many tables you can reserve. When those people show up, we'd love to have people to come in. And that's why we actually advise them to come on in on a walk-in basis and see if there's an opportunity, because there invariably is.
Where do you go after your restaurant closes or when you're still out on the town to eat?
Well, New York's filled with options to eat after closing. You know, between 12 and 4, there's hundreds, literally hundreds of restaurants. I guess my biggest thing right now is the Korean food, though. The Korean town that we have in New York City is pretty much 24 hours a day. You go up there, and they will bring you plate after plate of meat that you grill on your table. They have a little barbecues in the middle of the tables. And then you take the grilled meats, and you wrap them in lettuce leaves with all of these different pickled vegetable things they call kimchi, which is kind of spiced and vinegared roots and cabbages that are just absolutely delicious and very much something that I kind of crave after Western food all week. It's absolutely delicious. And it's also really good with beer, which is something that you kind of crave after working a hot night in the kitchen.
Well, Mario Batali, thanks very much for talking with me today. It was fun.
Thanks for having me.
Mario Batali is the chef and co-owner of the restaurants Babo, Po, Lupa, and Otto in Manhattan. He collects some of his favorite recipes in his books Simple Italian Food and the Babo Cookbook. Coming up, a review of a newly reprinted Virginia Woolf essay. This is Fresh Air. In 1925, the poet T.S. Eliot asked his sometime friend, Virginia Woolf, to write an essay for a new magazine he was starting. She responded by writing On Being Ill. Unlike other Woolf essays, like A Room of One's Own, On Being Ill has not been republished in an individual book since 1930. The Paris Press, a nonprofit press that publishes neglected work by women writers, has just brought out an edition of On Being Ill, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation.
Write what you know, advises the old saw, and what Virginia Woolf knew, as well as she knew the ins and outs of English sentence structure, was what it was like to be sick. Mental breakdowns, severe headaches, depression, mysterious prolonged fevers, heart troubles, extreme weight loss, neurasthenia, and suicide attempts, the last one successful, mark Woolf's adult life. No wonder she gravitated to the subject when she was invited to write an essay for T.S. Eliot's magazine, The New Criterion. Eliot published the essay in January of 1926, but he didn't like it. Woolf's herky-jerky style wasn't his cup of tea, nor was her subject. Notoriously disassociated from anything below his own neck, and tormented by his sick first wife Vivian, Eliot would probably rather have read a cereal box than this, an essay by a woman on bodily dysfunction. On Being Ill hasn't exactly been lost since 1930, when it was published as a standalone book by Woolf's own Hogarth Press, but it's been hard to come by. In fact, a normally docile colleague of mine who teaches courses on the literature of pathology nearly ripped the essay out of my hands when she saw me reading it. This new, attractive edition by the Paris Press reproduces the original book jacket art by Woolf's sister, painter Vanessa Bell. It also features an introduction by acclaimed Woolf biographer Hermione Lee, who, among other insights, points out the subtextual toying with suicide that runs through On Being Ill. Lots of fine writers throughout the 20th century have written powerful first-person essays about being sick. Woolf distinguishes herself from that crowd of fellow misfortunates by, for better or worse, avoiding confessional revelations, and, of course, by her powers of illumination as a stylist. To loosely quote Eliot, Woolf takes us back to common thoughts, experiences, states of mind, only to know the place for the first time. The temptation with Wolf is that when she's at her quicksilver best, a critic like me just wants to surrender and quote her extraordinary sentences rather than talk about them. Wolf opens with one of those trademark page-long grandstanding sentences that demands to know why illness has not been among the chief themes of literature. She then ruminates on a subject that's received a lot of critical attention in recent years, namely, how few words for pain there are in the English language. The merest schoolgirl, when she falls in love, Wolf says, has Shakespeare or Keats to speak her mind for her. But let a sufferer try to describe a pain in his head to a doctor, and language at once runs dry. He is forced to coin words himself, and taking his pain in one hand and a lump of pure sound in the other, as perhaps the people of Babel did in the beginning, so to crush them together that a brand new word in the end drops out. Probably it will be something laughable. Wolf teasingly talks about the dearth of real sympathy the sick receive, given that listeners reflexively talk about their aches, their gastric troubles. She's also witty on the solitude of sickness, calling the ill deserters in the army of the upright. Then, in a flash, Wolf becomes gloomier on the subject of sickroom isolation. That illusion of a world so shaped that it echoes every groan, where however strange your experience, other people have had it too, is all an illusion. We do not know our own souls, let alone the souls of others. Human beings do not go hand in hand the whole stretch of the way. On Being Ill veers off, as Wolf's writing sometimes does, into a bizarre final digression, this one about two minor female figures in English history that makes some of T.S. Eliot's frustration with this essay understandable. But before she disappears into the fog, Wolf talks vividly about the liberating effects of illness and about the stark knowledge of endings it bestows upon the recumbent. One of the most moving things about this singular essay is how Wolf's language goes to battle here. She gives the body its full due, acknowledging how hunger, toothaches, racing pulse beats, and nausea, among other ills, blunt the mind. But while paying homage to illness, her own greatest adversary, she also marshals her words to transcend it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed On Being Ill by Virginia Woolf. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And by Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, American foreign policy and the challenges to future U.S. preeminence and global stability. We talk with Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The End of the American Era. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Museum, a medical museum that documents deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases and trauma. She says while these bodies may be ugly, there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure these afflictions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.